The following live presentation by Rabbi David Aaron is brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To learn more about Israelite, please visit our website at www.israelite.org. Additional contact information is available at the end of this presentation. Thank you for learning with Israelite and enjoy the experience.
For the last class, it would be good to do a review. But I don't know if I could do it in 1 hour, but I'll try. I'm actually interested in reviewing the philosophy course, bringing it together, because it really is, if you could understand that course, then everything will fit into it. You'll see, as you saw with the Yom Kippur class, you just can ask all the questions you want of any festival, and once you have the fundamental ideas of the system, it works. There's a code, there's a system, how Judaism is constructed. So we started off the course with a discussion of what is education and what is truth. And we presented the idea that education, we believe, is a process of memory, reminding people that ultimately you will not hear something new, but you'll hear something actually quite old. That the Midrash says that when you're in the womb of your mother, the angel taught you the entire Torah, and as you're being born, you forget the whole thing. Life is to regain consciousness of that which you know unconsciously, in the subconscious. And that's what study is all about. And although truth is a big word, what does it mean to search for truth? It means to find that articulation that most precisely reflects that which is. What is, can't argue with that. What is. But now we want to know, how do we describe is? And what are the ramifications of our behavior in terms of is? And that would be what Judaism would then call truth. But is, and now we're trying to describe it. If we all closed our eyes and I passed around something, you've touched it, you felt it. Now you describe what it is. Right? Describe what it is. And I think we've all touched and encountered life enough. We're not 8 years old. Right? We've encountered enough life that it is possible to discuss, based on experience, rationale, heart, soul, mind, you know, what would be a realistic description of our encounter with is. And a religion, what does it mean to find a religion? I think it would mean to find an approach to is. There's Judaism. There's Buddhism. There's the ism, and then there's the particular approach to that ism. And even if when we describe is, we could agree on certain universal formulae, that would not in any way imply that there is not a unique approach that various nations or individuals would then have to what is. As I'm sure you've all heard, you know, there are 4 blindfolded men holding on to an elephant, but one's holding on to the trunk, and one's holding on to the legs, and one's holding on to the tail. And they say, what is an elephant? And they, one person, well, an elephant is very thick and heavy. And one said, well, it's very kind of like loose and flexible. And one said, well, it's kind of like ropey feeling. Right? So there's no doubt that when people encounter what is, there will be various distinctions in terms of their unique encounter with what is. So what is so encountered by the Jews and so conceptualized is divine light. That's how we describe it. That's not what it is. That's how we describe what is. We clarified the nature of language and its limitations. And everybody's familiar with the difference between the menu and the meal. And no one will be satisfied eating the menu, even though it clearly articulates what the meal is, but it's the meal that it should be directing you to. So we have to understand the nature of words. They reflect reality. They might be limited. And Judaism definitely accepts that the words and the concepts are allusions to what is. Right? And that we have to, on one hand, respect words for how they can communicate and help us contact is. On the other hand, we have to remain and maintain the limitation. Do not substitute the words for the reality that they are pointing to. The word love points to a certain encounter with a reality that people have encountered. As we grow up, the word love hopefully will mean deeper things. So too, the word God points to reality. And hopefully, the word God will have a different meaning, a more profound meaning, when I'm 30 years old than when I was 13 years old. It grows, even though it's the same word. The problem with faith today is, when you say God, they associate with the meaning that it had for them when they were maybe 8 years old, right? And if you ask a person, you believe in God, and it triggers off their image, as if there is an image of God of 8 years old, now that they're 35 years old or whatever, they say, no, I don't. But we have to be able to be clear on the limitations of our language and how language grows in terms of how it is a vessel for receiving the reality that it was pointing to. So what is the words we use, the concepts that reflect it, the conceptualization of our encounter with is divine light. And what does that mean? We encounter reality as an expression of God. Right? What is what we call God, and what we encounter is the revelation of what is what, and what is what we call God. And in fact, it's not what we call God. We don't believe in God. We believe in Hashem. Yud, the He, the Vav, and then the He. And what does that word come from? Was, is, will be. Hu haya, hu hoveh, v'hu yiyeh. That I'm encountering the was, is, will be of life. And everything I see in the world is a manifestation of the was, is, will be. Hashem. All of existence is a divine light. That's how we live. That's how we conceptualize our encounter with what is. Of course, it's a little problematic to say what is, because our encounter with is not so impersonal to say what, but who. Who is? If I'm in the room, I'm looking at my children, they're sleeping, then the words that would best describe what I know at that moment, what I've just encountered, is not, oh, what a beautiful evolved monkey. That's just not what I know. Those are not the words. What is, and what have I encountered? I've encountered, I'm simply trying to describe it so I can be true to myself and go on. What do I describe? The only words that would come close to in any way conveying to myself what I felt I've just encountered is what a gift, what a creature, what a creation, what incredible compassion, what incredible kindness. I feel so gracious. That's just what I encounter. I describe what I encounter. And for me to say, oh, what a big bang. Oh, what a fantastic evolution. That just wouldn't be the words. In terms of honestly saying that that's what I encountered, and those words would describe them. So we understand reality is an expression of God, and everything that we encounter in reality, we encounter in that way. And what is no longer what, but is a who, because is personal, and yet is impersonal sometimes. Is close, and is far. Hashem. And all that we encounter in the world is the manifestation of who is. The was, is, will be, Hashem. That's what Jews live with. That's Judaism, the Jewish approach to the ism. Right. That's our encounter and the description of it. Now, we then did an article of Rav Kook, a summons to a higher contemplation, which is a very beautiful, poetic opportunity to enter into the soul of the tzaddik. And just get a little taste of, we're not always on the highest level. We're not always walking down the street and saying, oh, what is, oh, look, oh, it's all Hashem. You know, we're not always there. But to just get a chance to taste a little bit of this man's encounter as a representative of a halachic Jew, a Kabbalistic Jew, a Jew whose father was Jewish, father's father was Jewish, a person who is part of the long tradition of the Judaism. Right? So it's a wonderful opportunity to get a taste of what could be our encounter with what is, and to augment that. And the goal of the Jewish people, Shaviti Hashem Lenegdi Tamid, I place before me the Yud, the Hey, the Vav, and the Hey, always. Wherever I go, what do I see? The He who was, is, and will be. Hashem. Okay. We then developed the notion of motivation from this point of view. That if all is like the light of God, and what is, then what really drives human beings, it's called emunah. It's the need to portray what is. And when I successfully portray what is, or who is, I feel happy, I feel meaningful, I've done what we would call a mitzvah. But when we behave in a manner which is incompatible with what is, then we feel cut off, and the action becomes its own punishment. We feel alienated, sometimes from ourselves. We feel we're not real. I mean, that's the question. What does it mean to be real? Huh? Is your behavior portraying, in the most honest, most authentic way, what is your encounter with what is, and the derivative behavior that's implicit in that encounter? If a person were to encounter life, they would behave in a different way. If a person was in a forest, they're going to have an experience and then leave all their garbage in the middle of the forest. But another person, they have an encounter with what is Hashem in that forest. They're not encountering trees, but they've had an encounter, a profound encounter that tells them deep in their souls, I can't just leave my garbage all over this place. That would be wrong. Why would that be wrong? What do you care? There's lots of woodlands and no one would ever find your garbage here. And maybe after a long period of time, it would just like decay and actually fertilize the land. You know, you can come all up with all kinds of things, but you have this very deep voice from within and also from without that seems to tell you, don't litter. Right? Turn around and before you know it, there's a bear. Right? Smokey the Bear. Right? But you had an encounter with is, Hashem. And is not lifeless. And is doesn't seem to be less conscious than I am sometimes. Sometimes I wonder, I don't know. I just describe my encounters. And I live with them. And I want to portray them in my actions. I want to portray them in my speech, in my thought, in what I want. Because what I want is what is wants. What Hashem wants. I'm in touch. I'm real. The next step is, so what is, who is, light, divine light, all an expression of God. All is an expression of perfection. What about all the imperfection in the world? Well, what is the nature of perfection? Is perfection dynamic or static? Can the perfect become more perfect? Or, if the perfect became more perfect, that would imply that it initially was imperfect. So then the perfect is statically perfect, was perfect, static perfection. So how could there be change in the world? How could there be a creation of a world? If the light of God is the light of perfection, then what's the nature of that light? And we developed a paradox. That in the beginning, God created a vacuum, withdrew the light. In the vacuum are these vessels, multiple vessels. There's a breakdown. God gives his light to the vessels. The vessels break down. There's chaos. There's breakdown, yet there's fixing. What was this all telling us? That included in the manifestation of divinity is precisely dynamic perfection. An imperfection with the possibility to become more perfect. While simultaneously the light still fills the vacuum, all is perfect, statically perfect. Right? And with that understanding of the manifestation of perfection, we then understand, how is it that we exist? What are we doing here? How is it that the world is imperfect? How is it that God would create an imperfect human being? If creation is an act of divine expression, then what is the imperfection of me doing here? The Jewish perspective is, that's precisely what's perfect about you. You play out the becoming perfection. You in your imperfection and your struggle to become more perfect is precisely divine perfection. What kind? The dynamic kind. There are not two values of perfection. There's only one light, when described by us, has two values. Right? A dynamic value, which includes imperfection with the possibility to become more perfect, and another value which is simply statically, completely perfect. And the world reality is an expression of perfection. And being that perfection would have this dynamic quality also, we would then have to describe that at the point where Hashem chooses to manifest, it would be expected that on the stage of reality would appear a human becoming. A character who is imperfect and struggling to become more perfect. That's precisely the kind of perfection they represent in reality. And this is one of the meanings of covenant. What kind of relationship could man have with God? What kind of partnership could there be between man and God? Man in his imperfection, his struggle to become more perfect, contributes, so to speak, to the full light of perfection. Not as if God needs man, because remember, man is an expression of God. Right? He is an expression of God. He is not God, but he is an expression of God. But that biblical notion and image of covenant represents that metaphysical truth in terms of the imperfect character struggling to become more perfect. And what motivates a human being is not to be perfect, but to become perfect. And that, in essence, we are not human beings, we're actually human becomings. And it's not for you to finish the work. But you're not free to stop doing it. And you don't get pleasure out of achievements, you really get pleasure out of achieving. And achievements are only ways of plotting the graph of my becoming. So we understand now that what we encounter is the dynamic expression of God as it's expressed in creation, in nature, and in human beings. And if we were to metaphorically describe the world as a stage, a drama that represents and plays out a truth, then there are various stars of the show and various, peas and carrot people. There's the people in the background, there's the props. But everything together contributes to that drama that expresses what is, who is, which is perfect. And therefore, imperfection, when it is within the context of becoming more perfect, is part of perfection. Only when it's within the context of growing. So life is a becoming. Life is a becoming. Life has struggle to it. Don't expect it not to have a struggle. But life isn't necessarily suffering. Suffering means I'm struggling, but there's no meaning to it. I'm going through pain, but there's no meaning to it. But when pain and struggle has meaning, and in this case, Judaism endows it with absolute divine meaning. God is with you with your struggles. God is with you in your pains. Then you understand that the immanent light of God is the soul that pushes forward the struggle towards becoming more perfect. And that itself is all part of the expression of godliness. However, can we conceptually structuralize the becoming? And the way Jewish mysticism structuralizes the becoming is there's the will, the goal, the plan, the principles of organization or the values, and the particular activity. If I saw someone in a process of becoming their painting, well, then there's the will that drives the whole process through. There's the goal, which, like a garment, clothes the will, and the will activates the garment. And then there's the plan, which itself is like a garment on top of the garment, which is on the will. So we have the will, the goal, the plan, the principles of organization, and the particular activity. The will drives the whole process through. The goal and the plan drive the whole process through. The goal and the plan produce principles which are coordinated with the goal and plan to direct the particular process towards the fulfillment of the plan, the goal, and the will. So, if a person wants to paint, they first need a goal. What's their goal? They want to paint security. That's what they want to express. What's your plan? Right. The plan is, I want to paint a picture of a mother holding her child. Okay, what's the principles? I mean, does it, you want it to be like an abstract kind of painting? Or is it like dots? Or is it would it be with pastels? Maybe not painting? Maybe watercolors? Right? That's already the method, which would have to be appropriate to the plan and the goal, which will ultimately fulfill the will. So the method, the principles of organization that will direct the particular process is a function of the goal and the plan. Okay? And it is the bridge that connects the particular to the visions. Right? There always has to be the values and principles that are the connection between the action that I got to do now and the goal, the vision of the future. So, in this case, what is the particular activity as so perceived by us? In this case, the particular activity is born out of a concern to synchronize myself to the principles in a manner that I would then be contributing consciously to the plan and the goal in such a manner that my particular will would be completely harmonized with the universal will. And we expressed scientifically how in fact the need for synchronization and perfect rhythm is a scientific fact. A phenomenon that we find in every area of life, a yearning towards harmonious, perfect, rhythmic relationship. And so too the human being. The human being feels deep down inside their deepest levels, their innermost being, a need to coordinate themselves to some greater context of movement. That we almost feel as if we are each musicians contributing to an orchestra. And yet we experience the orchestra not as the subtotal of the musicians, but the orchestra has a life of its own, has a reality of its own, and to a certain extent it plays through us, and we serve it. It's not simply the subtotal. And the goal of a musician is to coordinate themselves within the orchestra, to follow the directions of the conductor. And that musician wants to know the beat. They want to know the key. And to transgress the key signature is only self-defeating. Because the more out of key and out of rhythm I am, the more I feel disconnected from the orchestra, the more I feel meaningless. And it is very possible all of a sudden I have this strange urge to become a solo tuba player. Say, oh, go on, who needs an orchestra? I've got to subdue myself. I've got to serve this orchestra. I gotta listen to some conductor for my fulfillment? I don't need that. I'll write my own tuba songs and I'll go out and become the greatest tuba soloist in the world. But it doesn't work. Because I know that my tuba has meaning within the context of a total orchestra. And that my definition as a tuba player includes the trombone player and the violins and the drummer. And ultimately, my tuba playing includes the whole orchestra, which is greater than the sum of its parts. And really, there's this profound pleasure when I could completely synchronize and we are just jiving. And it's just like all of a sudden, like one organism, I get to a point where I feel like I'm playing the tuba. On the other hand, I feel like I am the tuba and the orchestra's playing me. And there's this really profound pleasure. And the pleasure itself is an indication that I've touched on something that portrays a reality. So I want to synchronize. That's what I want to do. I want to synchronize my life with the life of the orchestration of life. And I want to be in beat with the conductor. And I have a friend who's a conductor. He said the most ecstatic times of his life was when the communication between him and everyone in the orchestra was so perfect that if he would just think in his mind that he wants a particular roar from the trombone section, it would happen at the same moment he thought it. It was so profound. Right? He wouldn't have to move. He wouldn't say it. He wouldn't have to say, this is what I want. And they would say, oh, conductor wants this. Let's give him a roar. At the same time, they would feel the conductor directing them from without and from within their very souls. It was a very profound experience. That's all Jews, and that's all the world has been trying to do since the beginning. Portray life with music, with art. We want to portray what we're part of. So there is a very clear need to synchronize my particular life with a cosmic life. The life of the whole greater than the sum of any parts, prior to any parts. And the parts are actually playing it out. But there is this unique, mysterious ability of free choice. I've got the choice to synchronize or not to synchronize. And when I synchronize, I draw into the process the light of the vision. When I synchronize, I draw into the now the visions of eternity. The goal and the plan become apparent when I'm synchronized. And when I'm not synchronized, that doesn't even look like there's a goal. It doesn't even seem like there's a plan. So, how does one synchronize and attune themselves to the orchestration of life? How do you find the musical score, the beat, the music, the key? It's mitzvahs. Judaism claims that mitzvahs are the notes that coordinate to the music. You know, that's another experience that many musicians have. They feel Beethoven's being played already, right now. And if you could just get a musical score that gives you the notes, you would actually simply be a vessel for it. People have had that experience. They feel like Beethoven is playing right now. That song is in existence already, and we want to be the vessel for it to be manifest right now. And we need these notes. What is the music in these notes? You look at these little black squiggles. It's the music. And some musicians, they play it, and you say, not Beethoven. It's not Beethoven. Maybe roll over Beethoven, but it's not Beethoven. You know what I mean? They followed the notes. They, you know, but they just didn't jive. It just wasn't. The mitzvot are based on a concern for emunah. Emunah is the drive to dedicate myself to what is and successfully portray it and bring it into the world. And that's where mitzvahs come from. That power to synchronize. So the mitzvahs in halakha, Jewish law, is like the footprints on the dance floor. The dance is there. And you follow it, and you follow those footsteps in the beginning, it's hard, right? But all of a sudden you get into such a momentum that it's no longer you dancing, You've tapped into the dance that dances through you at that moment. You're carried. Your feet go to the right place. Your hands. It's just a very exciting experience. And that's the experience that one can have with Jewish law, Jewish mitzvot, because that's what it's based on. That's what it claims to do. That it is the way of God. You emulate God's way. You learn how to plug into the way of God as it is expressed in the universe. Now, of course, let's face it, there are the trombone players, there are the tuba players, there's the drummer, there's the violinist, there's the celloist. Do you think they have the same notes in front of them? No. There's an orchestra. There will be certain similarities if we would compare the various musical scores that the conductor gave out. We would see certain clear unifications and similarities. But in terms of how I contribute and how I serve the orchestra and the conductor, there will be differences. And therefore, Judaism is not interested in making everyone play a Jew's harp. You know what I mean? But rather, there are other people. And the great conductor, Mashiach, will come in and he will give out the parts, how you plug in, if you haven't figured it out yet. But Jewish people have their parts very clearly written out with the key, the beat, the rhythm. And that's the mitzvot. And we're not interested in imposing it on anybody other than Jews who can play Jew music, right? Who can play the Jewish instruments of life. Other musicians in this orchestra serving the orchestration and the conductor. That's the mitzvot. Judaism claims that the mitzvot will coordinate the individual with the will of God. And you'll be real. You'll be real. And when a person neglects the mitzvot, you're not real. You're not in touch with reality. And you get to a point where you're not even there, because you're just not plugged in to what's going on here. So that's the mitzvot, so Torah says, and the choice is whether I actively choose to synchronize myself and relate myself to the conductor, or whether I find myself a victim and do what I have to do in this magnificent divine orchestration in a way that I didn't even know I did it. What's the Torah? The Torah or those principles. They're the notes, but of course the notes are based on certain basic musical theory. Right? There's theory. And all music has to follow a certain principle. And there are principles in life. And what is, those principles existed. And Torah is the articulation of those principles. That's what we say. And just as before anyone came up with the name gravity, whatever that force was, it was and it is and it will be. And after a certain period of time, someone succeeded in articulating it and said, apples fall. People fall. Things fall. Force, gravity. Now what? Who cares? Now that I know the principles, I'll know how to follow them. I'm not going to disregard them if I'm going to build a building or a plane and say, well, forget about the principle of gravity right now. Let's just get down to building what we've got to do. You say, oh, thank God someone is clarifying various principles so that we can make the best out of it. Right? Why in the world anybody assumes after science has proven how precise the principles of the physical workings of the world is, that there is any less spiritual principles, I don't know. Right? I don't know. For me, science only encourages me more that we're looking for the spiritual scientist who can successfully articulate the spiritual principles upon which life must conform, the ethical principles that life must conform, and I don't see why there should be any less precision. Especially when I feel in my life that there are certain spiritual principles that, you know, if you do it this way, it works spiritually. If you do it that way, it doesn't work. Right? For instance, things like love. There are principles. We can sit and talk, well, what will bring about love and what won't bring about love? Now, you can talk about that. It exists. People can talk about it and say, yes, these are principles that if they're missing, you're not going to get to real love. That's just the facts. So what happened at Sinai? Through the collective mind of the Jewish people and the leadership of Moses, they actually received the Torah. It was given. Just as a genius would never say, I figured it out. Geniuses appreciate this unusual moment where it just hits them, and there's a little light that kind of beeps over their head. Idea. Ding! Well, that's a prophecy. I mean, that's a given. It's a revelation. They would come out. What would they call it? We're just looking for words. What is. Just want to call it. They say, what a revelation. Because that's what it is. That's the best word. I'm looking for words. Well, at Sinai, we have to say, the only words that could describe it as we understand it is a revelation. A complete clarity of the principles upon which the spiritual world functions and the ethical world functions. Principles that are crucial to directing the world towards the fulfillment of the goal of life and the coordination of my will with a universal will. That's what Judaism believes. And that's what Judaism calls the Torah. The principles which govern the movement of life towards the fulfillment of the plan. And the Zohar says, you're fulfilling Torah whether you know it or not. But the opportunity of choice is you could know it and then enjoy it and receive the expanded mind of being part of this and the joy in that. That's what Torah says. So those are the principles. What's the goal and the plan? What's the theme of life from whence these principles come and are concerned in serving and bringing about? So the theme of life is the revelation of God, God's oneness. What's being revealed is oneness, so we understand. What kind of oneness? Not the oneness in our dictionary, which is the opposite of manyness, because that would be a limited oneness. And God's oneness couldn't be limited. Rather, the oneness that we believe in is a oneness that is non-dual. And the closest manifestation, or the closest word we have in our dictionary that in any way suggests the kind of oneness God is in the manifestation of divine oneness is love, but real love. Love is that oneness. Because the oneness of God is this transcendental oneness that can give place and space to otherness, diversity, and yet still remain simply one. How is oneness or love manifest? The plan is giving of your goodness to another. And how do you get, what is giving goodness to another? First, you have to establish their otherness, allow them to be other, and then give of your goodness to that other. And what is the goodness that God would give man? What would be the greatest goodness? Judaism says, God. What is God going to give man? God. The light in the vessels. What does that mean? God is going to offer the other the possibility of including God in their lives. So the goal is the revelation of divine oneness. The plan is to give of his goodness to another. The principles upon which that is fulfilled. How does God give of his goodness to another? What are the principles that will allow for such a thing to happen? Allow for human beings to receive that light of godliness, that closeness, that oneness, that realization of divinity in their lives. That's the Torah. Those are the principles that govern a mode of behavior which is based out of the concern of including God in my life and exposing the oneness that I actually share with God. At that point, the individual enjoys the eternity of their being. at that point. And through that whole process, what have I ultimately done? What it says in the chapters of our fathers, make your will as God's will. And He will make His will as your will. There will be this mutuality, this inclusiveness, this mutual inclusiveness. My will including God's will including my will. We are one. And so ultimately, the theme of life is love story. And real love story, whether it's between parent and child or husband and wife, is making that whole in your life to include another, cultivate them in terms of their individuality and otherness, and give of yourself completely to that other in a manner that you will be completely included in their lives and they will be completely included in your life, and you will taste the mystery, the ecstasy of complete oneness and yet still distinction. And so the drive, the theme of life for Judaism is love, love between man and God, and love between man and fellow man. The visions are visions of world peace, universal love. And when we learn how to do that, learn how to love God and learn how to love fellow man, learn how to bring and portray the non-duality of divinity as it's so expressed in peace and love, then we have fulfilled the universal will. And every mitzvah in its very particularness, Judaism claims, is a fine-tuning method for the Jew to tune in, coordinate, and relate themselves to the divine in a manner that they will enjoy this lofty level of the oneness between the human and the divine, and the oneness between the human and all other humans. When we choose to transgress, all we've done is promoted the illusion of our separateness of the ground and source of life, Hashem. And in causing ourselves to be separate, we are not real. However, even the separateness could be used within the theme of love story, because even sometimes the fights, if they are used in a process of tshuva within the context of love, could also contribute. And therefore, even the times when I'm out of sync, when I want to get back into sync, those very moments when I was out of it can be used and converted into energy sources for getting even more into it. So, Judaism claims it is a book of life, it is a way of life. There's a way of accessing life, plugging into life. The Jews always believed it was an opportunity more than the Jews kept the Torah kept the Jews. This is what Judaism believes in. Whether you believe in it or not will be ultimately your choice, right? Whether you want to believe in it. Judaism offers evidence for it, right? But I don't believe it could ever be conclusively proven, because that itself would be counterproductive to its theme, which is to give people the choice to enter into a relationship with God. If I was forced to enter into a relationship with God, then this would not be a relationship. Therefore, I must have the choice, I must have the ability, and it will never be conclusive. It'll be reasonable, but just as when I went out with my wife, there's a way of knowing that this is the right person for you that goes beyond lists, formulas. There's a way of knowing, right? You can know that this is the right person. There is a way of knowing that I have been created to do this. There's a way of knowing I could never prove to anybody that I was created to teach. Right? It's very possible that I just disproved it in the last 6 weeks. But you can never prove it. But I still can know. that I'm created with a very clear purpose. I've got a mission in this world, and I got to take directions from some being beyond myself. These are clear, just as clear as any encounter with reality right now. I simply want to be real and describe it, not only with my words, but with my actions, and be true to my encounter with reality. He who was, is, and will be Hashem. The problem of our generation is we don't know what Judaism is. And for many of us, what we thought it was seems to be counter to what our hearts would tell us a life of joy and meaning would be. And therefore, we say, who needs Judaism? We're looking for something more important. It's understandable. However, I believe very strongly that we are probably in one of the best situations we can be in. Because when it comes to feeling separate, I think after the Holocaust, mankind has hit rock bottom. And God has allowed for Himself to be completely nullified. God has allowed for there to be a situation where people could even ask, I don't know if there really is a God. And yet, in that precise time, that's when people are going to begin to start to yearn for God once again. You don't know what you got until it's gone. Just the facts. Just the facts. And so, I believe very strongly that to be a Jew is an opportunity. That in our day and age, we can hear the voice of God from Mount Sinai, not just as an imposing authority, but as an exposing lover. And that if I'm a Jew and I teach Judaism to Jews, it's not that I'm a masochist, but that I honestly have encountered it to be a way of life, a way of God. And therefore, I share it with people. I share it with people. If you have at any point felt that you've been brainwashed, I'm not sure what that means. If it means that your brain was dirty before, so then I would accept perhaps. Maybe. I don't know. Right? I don't know. I've just tried as honestly as I can to present Judaism as I know it, as I have studied it, as I've researched it, and how I've experienced it in my personal life, in my family life, in the community life, and as I understand it and has been taught to me within the context of Jewish history. And I simply believe that any Jew that does not choose Judaism has really not choose life for themselves. That's my belief. Right? I'm not proving that. Right? Because it's not something that belongs to the mathematical world of 2 plus 2 equals 4. Thank God. It doesn't, because then we'd simply be robots. But I really hope that these 6 weeks have had and will have significant meaning in your life. I hope that what you heard resonates from within also. I think it has. I don't know. And it might take a while before you feel comfortable to accept that, or maybe it doesn't. I don't know. But what I do know is that a person should choose life. And if you can suggest a better way, then I am more than happy to hear it. Right. More than happy to hear it. So I do not present it in a dogmatic way, I hope, although maybe it sounds just like that sometimes. I present it in a way which is confident, derived from experience, and only as an invitation. Only as an invitation to join our people, your people, and do what we can do for ourselves and for the world. So I want to thank everybody. And it constantly amazes me that even after I have done this 17 times, not to mention when I taught these courses before I started Israelite, that every single Israelite is enlightening to me, and that I have learned a lot, even though it sounds like I talk a lot. But believe it or not, I listen, and I don't listen just to people's words. There are other ways of listening to people, which I think is possible. So I really thank everybody for what you've inspired for me. And I hope that this will not simply be notebooks that will be discovered in your attic 10 years later and open it up, blow off the dust and say, David Aaron, I remember him. Israelite. How did you spell that word anyways? I could never figure it out. Why did they spell it wrong? And, oh yeah, being, becoming, oh yeah, panenthi, yeah, oh yeah, well that was interesting. Yeah, I really, you know, maybe I should read these notes some other time. I hope that this was not simply a scholastic venture, because I'm not interested in scholastic ventures. I'm personally interested in offering people life, right? And sharing what I believe is the best precise articulation of the encounter with life and the source of life, Hashem.
This presentation by Rabbi David Aaron has been brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To access additional presentations from our online media library, order our best-selling books, or learn more about Israelite programming, including seminars, web-based learning, teleconferences, spiritual retreats, Shabbaton experiences, Israel missions, and leadership training, please visit us at www.israelite.org. That's www.israelight.org. You can also call us in New York at 212-947-4990 or in Jerusalem at country code 972-2-627-4890. We hope you enjoyed this presentation, and we look forward to learning with you at Israelite.